Succession number 22083, reel 11.
This is the sixth reel of a taped interview with Bill Mitchell in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 11th of the 7th, 2001, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Bill, I wanted to talk to you about coming home and what the feeling of the nearness of war was amongst those soldiers returning home again.
I think everybody was glad to be getting back to Australia. Everybody knew that it was far from over, but we got on that Liberty ship, and I think that was the roughest trip I've ever had. We ran into a cyclone sort of a thing, I used to curl up on the wood heap rather than go down below, because if you went down below, you'd be more sick than you were if you were up top in the fresh air. And on the rail of that ship, I saw a name being carved, D. Tonkin Kalgoorlie, and he finished up being my brother-in-law.
Your experience in New Guinea at this point hadn't been one of connecting with the Japanese forces?
No.
What of those that had been in touch with them? How did they mention their fighting abilities at that time?
Well, I think the general opinion of them, that the lips were a bit on the silly side, because when they made an attack, they'd blow bugles and yell and let you know that they were coming. And our blokes used to sneak in with as little noise as possible. But I think it doesn't matter who you're up against. If they got a gun and that, anything can happen. You got to treat them with a bit of respect, whether they're good or otherwise.
You mentioned earlier that they were sort of a force not to be reckoned with. Don't underestimate them was one of the things that your brother had said.
Yeah.
Was that something that those people that had experienced fighting with them had?
Oh, my word, yeah. They were, what I would say, they were nincompoop soldiers, you know. They'd do or die. If they had to do anything, they'd do it, or they'd get killed. What I can remember of them, they never used to retreat very much without, unless they were really getting hammered. They used to do some silly things. On one occasion, one of the fellows was telling me he heard this yell, and the next thing a nip went across, bounded across the track, and he was camouflaged with a bush. And about 10 minutes later, he let out the same yell and went across the other side. Or he started to go across the other side, and of course he got him. But anybody in their right, unless he was trying to draw their fire, which they did on occasions, one of them would stand up just to draw the fire, and they knew exactly then where our blokes were. That's what they told me, anyway. As I said, I never ever came in contact with them in New Guinea. But I know on one occasion there was two blokes who had the Bren gun, and it was raining, and they threw a ground sheet over it to protect it. And then all of a sudden, these nips come streaming out the bush, and they barely had time. Well, they didn't have time to pull the cover off the gun, and there was an officer with his sword. He slashed one bloke down the shoulder, and the other bloke put his hand up like that, and he sliced him down the hand with his sword. And then at that stage, one of our officers shot him. So,
what are the Australian soldiers in situation of combat? How did they compare to the Japanese in relation to their fighting ability?
Or, well,
their warrior sort of sense?
Oh, I think they showed more common sense than the nips, but most of them that I had anything to do with, there wasn't much fear amongst them. Well, I didn't show much anyway.
When you speak of the Japanese standing up to draw fire, was that something that an Australian soldier would have been prepared to do?
Oh, I don't think so. They'd have more sense to do that. I think that the Nips thought it was an honour to die for their emperor.
How do you think that part of their nature made them a more difficult soldier to fight?
Oh, well, I think it did. They were living in pretty torrid conditions too, you know, they'd be in their trenches and that. And sometimes they'd be in with a dead mate, and they wouldn't attempt to get him out and bury him, but they'd stay there until they were rooted out themselves. I don't know. As I said, I never had much contact with them in New Guinea, but the different blokes that came back told me, like my mate Howie on the Song River, the Nips came back up the coast in a barge and landed on Scarlet Beach, and then they sent a patrol through, and Howie told me he was on one side of the bush and the Nips passed on the other side, and he couldn't fire because they were in line with our own blokes, and of course they just had to let him go through, but one of the other patrols caught him a bit further up along the coast and wiped him out.
We can talk possibly about your connection with fighting the Japanese later on when we come to Borneo.
Yeah.
You were on another return home to Australia. What was the sense on arrival, and what happened then?
Oh, well, we came back to Townsville, and from there we went to a place called Ravenshoe, and of course once again we had to make another camp, and that was in a pretty good spot because we're not far from there was a river, and I know Tully Falls was on it, and we used to go down there swimming every day, like get up early in the morning and go down and have a swim before parade, And
what were you to do in Australia?
Well,
at that time, yes, we were talking sort of, as I understand, it would have been early 44.
Yeah. Well, we were camped in, as I said, we were camped at Ravenshoe, and we weren't there very long before we went out on leave. We came back to West Australia. We came back on, we used to cross the Nullarbor on, in cattle trucks. But they were all right, they were rough. But they had toilet bowls and all that sort of thing in it. But,
how long did the trip take to cross?
Oh, between 4 and 5 days.
What was the food like?
Oh, buddy, terrible in some places. On one occasion, I can remember, going back, that is, going back from West Australia to Queensland, we pulled into one place, don't know whether it was Mooney Ponds or, it was over in Victoria somewhere at any rate, and you could smell this meal before you got off the train, and it was made of dehydrated mutton and that, and that was one of the rare times that I couldn't eat it, so it was pretty crook.
How did the average soldier pass his day in a cattle truck going across the Nullarbor?
They were very noisy, like those that could played cards, and those that didn't play cards tried to sleep.
What did you talk about? What sort of things did you talk about?
Oh. Oh, I can't remember now.
What are some of the most what are some of the more important things that are in the mind of a soldier on leave heading home to Western Australia, do you think, in
1944? It's good, it's that long ago.
Had you heard much from your family in New Guinea?
We used to get mail reasonably regularly, you know, like, well, when I say regular, that you might get 3 or 4 letters 1 week, and then you wait another fortnight or 3 weeks before you got another one. Everything depended on how the ships and that were running.
So what was it like then to return to Kalgoorlie Boulder?
Yeah.
How long were you there for?
I think I had 21 days. The first leave, and that was 44, yeah, that's right, and while I was home, my grandfather died, so I applied for compassionate leave and got an extra couple of days so I could go to his funeral. That was in June. That's right, the 10th of June, 1944, his funeral was, and we landed on Labuan on the 10th of June, 1945. So
tell us about being on leave in Boulder.
Well, there wasn't much to do except drink beer and go to parties, and which we did do. It was almost a party every night. We used to get into the Kalgoorlie and go to the Australia Hotel, and you start off with 2 or 3 in the school, and if you were in the first 3 or 4 that were there, you used to buy in turn, and by the time lunchtime came, there'd be anything up to 20, so you never had to buy again. And So it always paid, in those days, it always paid to be in the first buy. And, of course, at that stage of the game, the brew that they were turning out was supposed to be in Hannon's brew, but it, the old brewer died in 1942. Yeah, that's...
Hannon's Lager.
Yeah, they're the best beer I've ever drank when it first came out, but the old brewer, he was a German brewer, what's more, he died in 1942, and whatever he had, he took with him. They could never, ever reproduce the same beer. One night at the Mines and City Workers Club in Boulder, I saw them pull 8 kegs down. Because they used to put them up on a shelf then and put a... they'd get them from the ice works and they'd put a felt blanket or something around them to keep them cold.
Now, Hannon was the chap that found gold in Kalgoorlie initially, wasn't he?
That's right, yeah.
So this beer was pretty special stuff.
Oh, it was. how it came about, Big K was the brew that they used to brew in Kalgoorlie up till 1935. But it got some wog in it, and they started importing beer. You could get Tiger, you could get West End, Richmond, West End, Swan, Emu. Well, there was two or three others that they used to bring from the eastern states. And so the bloke that owned the brewery, he went to England and bought this brewery. And he went to Germany and got the German brewer, bought him out. And within 6 months of them opening the Kalgoorlie, the Hannon's brewery, they called this one Hannon's, it kicked all the other beers off the market.
Okay. So for a soldier coming back on leave, what was the feeling of returning back to your hometown? How were you received in places like the Australia Hotel?
Oh, well, everybody used to... they'd all want to buy a drink, you know. Didn't matter who, you wouldn't know them from a bar of Burford's, and they'd want to buy you a drink. And
how did you feel about yourselves at this time?
About what?
About yourselves.
Oh, we're in pretty high spirits. I think generally things were going pretty good. At that stage, I don't think there was any feeling of despair or anything.
Were you given a sort of hero's welcome?
Well, not individually as such, because there was blokes coming and going all the time, and the people up there, they knew exactly what was going on. And
did people want to talk about the war to you?
Some of them did. Some of them wanted to know what was going on, but...
what was your interest in talking to them about your experience?
I don't think I ever did. We never, not that I can remember, I don't think we ever discussed the war at all.
What was to happen then between the time you were to come back to Australia and then head off to Borneo, what were you to do for most of that time?
Well, at that stage I'd transferred to the Pioneers, and we were was different altogether to infantry.
What were the Pioneers? Tell us about them.
Well, they were the blokes that if there was a bridge to be put over a stream, well, we used to put the bridge over. Any latrine or toilets that were to be dug, we dug them. For instance, when we were on Moratai, sort of a coral
rock
sort of stuff, and we were I had the job of digging a couple of latrines, and they gave us what we used to call beehive bombs, and there was a bomb that stood on three legs, and it was shaped like a cone, and you set this in position where you wanted to dig the hole, light the fuse, and then scarp her out, and she'd bang and she'd go down, and you'd have a hole about 4 foot deep, and all you had to do was clean it out, and then they put the latrines on top of it. In the meantime, when we were letting these off, they used to take every leaf off every tree within about 20, 30 yards. They were that powerful. But it was a lot easier than digging by hand.
So, going back to Australia, what you joined the Pioneers. What was your training? Were you to train or what?
Yeah,
in Australia?
Yeah, we used to learn how to tie knots, like all different knots, and because I knew how to handle dynamite and that, because of being in the mines. If there was anything needed building, like an oven, or they used to build big ovens out of corrugated iron and cover them over with mud and soil and that, to bake the bread. They'd have an open end and they'd shovel in logs and get the fire going, and when they were burnt out, they'd rake the coals out, and or everything bar the coals, and put the loaves of bread in, and used to turn out beautiful bread.
So your main duties in Australia for that almost a year were to train up.
Yeah.
To head off to Borneo. When did you know you were going to Borneo?
I know it was when we were on Moratai. That's when we knew, when we went. We left Australia and went to went back to Milne Bay for a short while, and then we went from Milne Bay to Moratai on the Menorah, I think it was.
What was it like to know that you were heading up back again?
Well,
hadn't you had enough of it by now?
Well, if they'd have given me a ticket to go home, I'd have gone home. But
what about your friends and family, leaving them again? What was it? What was that like?
Well, we're getting pretty used to it. It was just like.
So far, you've been lucky. You haven't been killed.
Yeah.
You've been wounded quite seriously. What was the feeling to say goodbye to your family again?
Oh. I can't really describe it. I never thought much about it. I don't suppose there was one stage where I did go act willy for 5 days, and I got fined £5 and 5 days' pay for it. But
As I understand, you were to leave in from Townsville in April of 1945. Now, at this point, things had started to really deteriorate for the Germans in Europe, and it would be a matter of a month before VE Day. The Americans had landed in the Philippines.
Yeah.
One of their main aims, particularly from MacArthur. What were your feelings then on leaving to go off to fight the Japanese force that weren't in great shape?
Well, I suppose it was just another day as far as we were concerned. We were told we were going there. We knew we were going heading up into the island somewhere, but we didn't know exactly where. And we got on this American troop ship. And it was only a 20,000 tonner, and of course the full battalion was on it, and it was pretty crowded. We only got two meals a day, and if you could find a bit of shade, well, you stuck to it, and when it came your turn to get another meal, you'd get in the queue, and somebody would have to get out of the place and then if you had a bit of luck, you could grab it. But otherwise, the blokes were standing up for hours and hours on end.
To what degree did it strike you that you weren't being treated particularly well?
Well, if I recall rightly, there looked like being a bit of a punch-up on the ship. The Yankee military police, or they were Marines, I suppose. There were certain areas where they didn't want our blokes to go and sit, and of course there was no room anywhere, so our blokes just went in there, and I heard one of the there was two of them talking together. I was on one side of the boat and they were on the other. And I heard him say to his mate, he said, "These are the toughest goddamn effers that I've ever seen." He said, "You just tell them to move and they tell you to stuff your face." I heard him say that.
So the reputation of the Australians was a pretty tough one.
Oh yeah, I've heard a couple of Americans reckon that the Australians were the best jungle fighters in the lot.
What do you think made them the best jungle fighters?
I don't know. I don't suppose they had any bloody brains, though. No. I just, if there was a job there to do, they did it.
And you were to head off to Borneo. There has sort of been a bit of question about whether there was any real need for you to do that, to go to Borneo.
Well, we didn't know it at the time, but in hindsight, it would appear that way. But we were told that they wanted to get the... there was an airstrip on... Labrun that they wanted to use, and they put a lot of effort. If it was something that wasn't necessary, there was a hell of a lot of ships, I forget how many was in the invasion force, but I know when we left Moratai, we were instead of heading the shortest way to Labrun, we went up on the right, I think it was the right-hand side of Borneo, went past it as though we were making towards the Philippines or somewhere. And then they doubled back, during the night they doubled back and come into Brunei Bay. And our landing was practically unopposed. I can only remember one, there was one machine gun out on a, it was a sunken ship, I think. And he only lasted about 5 minutes. The American gunners got him.